Okay, so tonight I thought I would talk about the worldly winds. And I know probably most of you have had teachings on the worldly winds. And I think in part I chose that subject because they have been so vivid in my experience since I came out of retreat. I came out of retreat and I really was struck by how the world is pursuing things other than what I had been doing for 4 months. For 4 months, I had been in pursuit of deep states of silence and stillness and happiness and contentment and equanimity. And, you know, it was just like a world that felt very other than the world that we know, and it is. And the states of jhana depend on a certain amount of seclusion from the world, seclusion from the efforts that people are making for, you know, success and pleasure and achievement and making their mark in the world. That's not what practice is about. So it really stood out for me, you know, when I came out. And not in a, it's just the way it is, you know. So we need to come to terms with what is worldly and what are the priorities of living in the world and what are the priorities when you take up a spiritual practice. You begin to shift your priorities. Would you say in your own experience that that has been true for you? Would you say that over time some of your priorities have shifted? And as you deepen in your practice, that simply continues. You see what's of real value and importance. So the worldly winds, which are 8 pairs of opposites, which describe the pursuits of all of us as we try to make our way through life. They are experiences that we all know. So as you listen, I'm not going to be giving you new information. Maybe for some of you this will be new, but for most of you, this is not new information, but your reflection on your own life and your relationship to these worldly winds may have some, it may wake up something for you. So what are they? Pleasure and pain, the biggies. How our lives revolve around seeking pleasure and avoiding pain. Success and failure. Again, how we in our own lives have looked for success and tried to avoid failure. Praise and blame. How much we like praise. How we don't like blame. And as a result of all these worldly winds, we feel either pride or shame. We feel good about ourselves sometimes, we feel bad about ourselves at other times. So when we hear teachings about the worldly winds, they are a way of reflecting on our lives and initiating a deep inquiry into what our priorities are. How much does receiving praise from people determine your actions? How fervently are you seeking to be praised? How fervently have you looked for pleasure or success? And we can all find that as we take a look inside. We live in a culture that says these worldly wins should be our aspiration and that attaining them will make us happy. That's the whole premise. But this is the way, this is the recipe for happiness, getting praise, having a life of pleasure and having great success, having fame and, you know, not failing. All of that is supposed to add up to happiness. But does it? It was the Buddha's great insight that he put forth in the Four Noble Truths, that the pursuit of material gain and praise and pleasure does not lead to the hoped for enduring kind of satisfaction or happiness. Pleasures are fleeting, temporary. They come and they go, and they're mostly not under our control. So when we are pursuing worldly wins, we are pursuing things that we have very little control over. You know, we hope for these things, pleasure and praise and success, but, you know, we're sort of always looking to see how's it going. Nothing we can rely on. So they're called worldly winds because winds bring change. Winds blow unpredictably. Winds can create havoc. To not be blown about, we need to be deeply rooted. We need to be deeply rooted. Buddhist focuses on what brings enduring happiness, contentment, peace, and freedom. This is what the Buddha looked into. How is it we suffer, and how does this suffering come to an end? In part, it comes to an end by not looking for happiness in the wrong place. Not looking in the place where it won't be found. But that takes some life experience, doesn't it, to finally get that. Maybe you have to have a great deal of success and then lose it, or maybe you have to risk being criticized, or maybe you have to see that fame is not going to give you the love you really have wanted. An interesting series of studies have shown that people are not very good at predicting what will make them happy. You know, we think somebody says, oh, I'm taking my family on a cruise with my children and my husband and my grandmother and everybody's coming. We're going to go on a cruise. And that's supposed to be like the culmination of something. I'm not sure what, but is that going to bring happiness? I don't know about you, but going on a cruise and eating 5 meals a day is like my idea of a nightmare. Nevertheless, that's what people sign up for. Or people just going on a vacation, putting all the family in a camper and going out into the mountains, whoopee-doo. People forget that what vacations can be like. You know, the travel can be stressful, unexpected things can happen, and, you know, it's strenuous going on. You have to exert a lot of effort. And maybe sometimes these things do seem worthwhile. But the idea that this is what will make you happy is what we're looking into, is what we're questioning. For the super wealthy who have huge quantities of stuff, McMansions in various parts of the world, it is the search for the best of everything, for the perfection that drives them. The perfect leather for the perfect handmade bag, the perfect bed linens, or the perfect porcelain teapot, I read an article where this is what drives people with a lot of money. It's they can have anything, but they need the best. So there's a realm in the Buddhist mythology called the jealous god realm. And this is a realm where people have indeed much pleasure, where things are given and people have wealth and well-being and health and, you know, lots of privilege. But they're constantly comparing themselves with each other. They're constantly feeling jealous and envious of what somebody else has that they don't have. They're constantly agitating for having the best, what's better than the neighbors. That's why it's called the jealous god realm. So they're suffering even when you have quite a bit. In fact, a friend of mine who was an undergraduate at Yale many years ago, he just went to his 50th high school reunion. Anybody been to their 50th high school reunion? And he said that this was it with him and Yale, that he probably would never go back. You know, it was nice seeing a few people, but what he noticed was how at Yale, there's so much envy. Like, you're only as good as your last book or your last, you know, job that gave you gazillions of extra dollars or something like that. That there was this underground talk at the reunion of achievement and posturing and, you know. So that's a kind of hell realm, really. So the Buddha brought this to our attention. He said, look at the worldly winds. Look at, they don't last. They change constantly. They blow unpredictably. Some interesting research on people's happiness set points. We all have a happiness set point where we kind of hang out for most of our lives. Yes, you know this research?
No, but I know myself.
Yes, yeah. A happiness set point, kind of like where we hang out. That's the best way to describe it. They don't change that much over a lifetime. We tend to revert back to our happiness set point equally after something which makes us very happy, like we inherit a lot of money or we win a lottery or something, or when something difficult happens, very challenging happens. Eventually we get back to the same happiness set point that we had before the difficulty arose. The only thing which seems to have more than a passing influence on our happiness set point, guess what it is?
Yes.
Mindfulness. Mindfulness to the rescue once again. Mindfulness. There's hardly any bad news with mindfulness. It's good for us, and it helps us over time learn to be happier and happier and happier. That's why it's such a great practice for aging, you know, because we find that truth, that as the body falls apart, we can still feel in ourselves an increase in happiness. Now, that doesn't correlate, really, but it's true. And mindfulness, of course, has gotten a lot of press, and you all have been practicing it, so you know the truth of it. But somebody new looking at mindfulness, how does that work? You sit by yourself in silence and you get happier? Like, what's that about? You know? How does that, it's not obvious, in other words. Mindfulness is often the last resort in our lives. You know, when we're dealing with something challenging, we try everything else first, or we take the vacation, or we buy a new house, or we change the relationships. Something that we think will do it, you know, that will make us happy. And, you know, it probably won't, but we have to do it anyway. Mm-hmm. Finally, we think mindfulness. Let's take a closer look at what's really going on that I'm seeking for outside of myself. So we begin to look more closely at our experience. There's a wonderful book out by Mingxue Rinpoche called To Love the World, Being in Love with the World or something. Or maybe it's just called In Love with the World. Do you know Mingxue Rinpoche? He's a lama. He's Sokni Rinpoche's brother, younger brother. He's a wonderful, we've had him at Spirit Rock. He's a wonderful, you know, next generation lama. He's in his 30s, maybe in his 40s now. Very bright guy.
What's the first name?
Mingxue. 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 He wrote a book called The Joy of Living. And now he has a book that describes something he did that was quite controversial. Like all lamas who are trained in the Tibetan tradition, he had a monastery. He has a monastery in Kathmandu, Nepal. And, no, I'm sorry, not in. In Bodh Gaya, India, yeah. And he decided that he wanted to be a wandering sadhu for some period of time. But he didn't tell anybody that he wanted to do that. He just ran away. He left his monastery and took off and didn't tell anybody where he was going, because he knew they would prevent him from doing that, because it's a very rough life to be a wandering beggar in India. But that's what he wanted to do. He just felt like there was something calling him in that. So he escaped from he's the abbot, now get this, he's the abbot of the monastery in Bodh Gaya. He escapes in the middle of the night with nothing but some cash in his pocket. He didn't have a passport. He had nothing with him. And his book is about what happened to him. Well, what happened to him was a lot of hardship, tremendous, tremendous hardship. But he took it on as practice. He took it on as practice. And he found what he was looking for, which was a deeper understanding of emptiness and impermanence and life and death. He really, you know, did a very brave thing, and now he has a best-selling book, so it has a happy ending, the story. But he said something that really struck, that I wanted to mention tonight. What is it? Let's see. Oh, he said, looking at the way we look at life is the essence of taking our life as our path. So the worldly winds are ways that we look at life. And through practice, we can look at how it is that that affects us. When we take pleasure as being a guiding principle of our life, what effect does that have? You know, what is the outcome of that approach to life? When we look at life as the pursuit of praise, how does that affect how we look at things? So what he's saying is that practice opens us to looking at everything differently. We, along with a shift in priorities, we have a shift in view. So we begin to see that the worldly winds have limitations. and looking at the life through a more Dharma-centered view brings to life a new perception of our own life. So seeing how we view things is an important part of our practice, and learning to see differently, to open our eyes to a different point of view. So gain and loss. Let's take a quick overview of the worldly winds. Gain and loss. Well, the best example we can possibly probably come up with is the ups and downs of the stock market. Mm. How it's mentioned every day, right? When you listen to the news, there's always some mention of what the market is doing. It's like, but it's that important that it has a spot on the news every day, the ups and the downs of the stock market. I have a student who is a stockbroker in Long Island, in New York. Wonderful man. He's discovered practice. But he freely admits that he's completely tied to the stock market. When he and his wife go on a vacation, he has to arm wrestle his phone from him to stop him from checking every hour, you know, what the market's doing. He's learned he can go without knowing for some period of time without things, you know, being catastrophic. But it's still very hard for him to let go of that addictive, like, needing to know, is it up or is it down? What can I do to make it? You know, he thinks there's some sort of magical thinking, like if he doesn't pay attention, it will really go haywire. Sports is another way. Who's winning? Who's losing? What is your team doing? Politics, another way that we get hooked into winning and losing, gain and loss. One time I had a woman come to me. She had been a fashion model. She was 38. It's not good to be a fashion model and 38, because she was losing jobs. She wasn't no longer young enough. She was no longer the right look for what was needed. And so she was going through a crisis in her life. It was a real midlife crisis, you could say, about her. Who was she if she wasn't the look of the moment? And it was like watching somebody grieve the death of a beloved friend or family member, seeing that this person that she had taken herself to be was no longer available, was dying. Whenever we get identified with one of these worldly winds, we feel it as a loss and a threat to our self-image when it changes, because change is inherent in the worldly winds. If you identify with success, when you fail, you will feel tremendous loss and a challenge to your self-image. I saw this beautiful movie last night. Have any of you seen Pavarotti? Yes. Wasn't that wonderful? Who would have... I was surprised. There's so much I didn't know about Pavarotti. One of the things was that he was very hard on himself. I mean, he was, you know... Who would say his voice needs to be better? Nobody but him. He had an ongoing kind of critique of himself, but it was sweet in the movie. Towards the end of his life, somebody played him a recording of him singing when he was much younger, maybe 30 years younger or something. And he listened, and he said, "Oh, that was really good. That's really good." So there was some healing of it, but, you know, overall, to think that he had been so hard on himself. You know, so we can, it doesn't, there's no limit to the way in which we can get caught in this idea about who we are. So our task with this is to see that everything changes. It has nothing to do with our abilities or our worth as a person or our talent. It's just change. And it has a kind of universal, it happens universally. It's not a fault of ours. The ephemeral nature of all conditioned things is what we look at over and over again in our practice. Renunciation, as Suzuki Roshi said, does not consist in giving up the things of this world, but in realizing that they go away. We talk a lot about renunciation in the Theravadin tradition, letting go of the worldly life. But if you never let go of the worldly life, you will still experience renunciation in the natural course of things, because things change. It's out of our control. We will experience that things go away. They just do. Our looks, our energy, our vitality, our good health. It's all going to go. It's all in the process of going. Right? Some of you who are young don't believe it yet. But you will find the truth of it as your own body kind of deserts you. It's like, wait a minute. What happened to that other body that I used to have? So Lama Yeshe said it perfectly. This thing about change, he said, chocolate comes, chocolate goes, chocolate disappears. All such transient pleasures are like this, but take heart. There is another kind of happiness available to you, a deep abiding joy that comes from your own mind. This kind of happiness is always with you, always available. Whenever you need it, it is always here. And that's kind of what we begin to feel. That's what we begin to realize, that what we've been looking for out here in the external world is actually right here. It's right here, as close as our breath. Another worldly win duo is praise and blame. Who hasn't learned from praise and blame? You know, it's a universal experience, it seems, for all of us. There's nobody who only gets praise. There's nobody who only gets blame. That we all experience both. Even the Buddha was the object of praise and blame. Some people thought he was a charlatan. He walked away. No matter what you do or don't do, some people will like you for it, and some people will not like you or even blame you for it. It's just the way it is. It's one of the big kind of lessons of teaching or being anything in public, you know. It's lovely when people praise you, but it's also true you get blamed. It just comes with the territory. Then there's pleasure, pain. Mm-hmm. dear old pleasure and pain. When things are painful, we tend to go into fear. Oh my God, is this going to last forever? What if it gets worse? What if it's life-threatening? You know, we immediately make a story when we're in pain, don't we? Yes, we do. Whereas with pleasure, we begin to get hopeful, like, wow, maybe those new vitamins are really kicking in and I'm, you know, it's going to bring back my youth or whatever. There's a saying, when we are young, the absence of pleasure is a pain. When we are old, the absence of pain is a pleasure. There we have it. So we do find pleasure in life. It's just that it's momentary. An actress, Terry Garr, who this poet is from many years ago, it's kind of dated, but it's still good. She said, it's not true that money can't buy you happiness. It can, but only for 10 minutes or so. When you first get the new stereo, it's a thrill, but pretty soon it's just another record player. Today we would say, first you get the new iPhone, it's a thrill, but pretty soon it's just another phone, right? We get used to it, and then we see something even greater and more interesting, and pretty soon it's outdated, and we're on to the next thing. So the worldly winds blow through our lives, and we get to experience all the opposites. Sometimes we're winning, and sometimes we're losing. Sometimes we're feeling the pleasure of being alive, and then we are racked by pain. We maybe have the experience of being crazed, and then somebody blames us for something. And it goes on and on. Sometimes in the span of a day, we can experience all of them, or even in one sitting. Do you take yourself on a spin? You know, going through the all of them. There is a sneaky and persistent belief that somehow it is our job to capture the pleasure, the success, the praise, and never ever fail or have pain or lose things. Because we have been successful in many parts of our lives, we feel empowered. We think it's up to us. That's a mistake. That's a kind of delusion. Maybe a delusion of the privilege to think that we're that much in charge of things. And we think this will make us happy. And when it does not, or does so only temporarily, we may think, well, there must be something wrong with me. I'm not doing it right. So, lastly, is pride and shame. We live in a culture, of course, that is obsessed with fame. And people, you know, who seem like they've got everything. Even small children catch on pretty early that the way to get attention in our culture is to be somebody special. Lily Tomlin has a line I've always liked from her, what was that show that she did on Broadway? Yes. There's a line from that show that she said, I always wanted to be somebody, but I guess I should have been more specific. That feeling of wanting to be somebody, you know, drives us when we're young. And when we aren't particularly famous or successful, we can feel the opposite. We can feel a sense of shame. Or we can look at other people who don't have much of that in their lives, or who aren't thought of as role models. And we can shame people who are different. We can shame people who are of another race, another ethnicity, another culture, another class, other gender preferences, sexual preferences. Also, older people are often shamed by the dominant culture. We lose it, right? We don't have it together anymore. We are invisible. We're a pain to many times to young people. I feel it sometimes when I'm shopping and I'm not moving fast enough in the line, or I'm looking for change in my purse and I drop things. And, you know, I can feel people just like, oh God, a white-haired woman, if somebody please take her out. Yeah. So shaming is something that we feel at times, but that is a very cruel dismissal by the dominant culture of those who are more vulnerable or disempowered. So what did the Buddha... I think there's a great resource in the Dharma when it comes to feeling shame or feeling not good enough. The Buddha and Martin Luther King said similar things about how to withstand being shamed. The Buddha said that if we are strongly rooted in a commitment to non-harming, we can remain equanimous in the face of others' judgment or shaming behavior. In other words, if we know in our heart, that our intention is wholesome and that we stand in our lives for something wholesome, we won't be so subject to other people's shaming or negative judging of us. You know, it's what Martin Luther King called it moral courage. He said it takes moral courage to withstand being shamed. And he was referring to many of the African American people in the South who, say, sat at lunch counters or sat in the front of the bus and risked, you know, violent reactivity or risked being shamed by the dominant white culture. But the dignity of their stand and their commitment to nonviolence gave them the strength and courage to withstand such hostile, shaming reaction. So you know, nobody wants to be shamed, but there is a place of refuge when you can find that sense of goodness in yourself, that sense of being in a wholesome place in your own heart and mind, where you don't participate in conflict. You are standing for something. But it's very important to see the story that we might tell ourselves when we feel shamed. And as certainly in my life, being an older person and seeing how it is for many older people. So the Dharma can help us with that. And the other thing about getting older is that I think also that if we are over 60, we perhaps have another view of the worldly winds. We can perhaps see them more objectively because we've survived their them blowing in our lives in different ways, right? Once you're over 60, you've experienced pretty much all the worldly winds, and you may have some wisdom about what the effects of the pursuit of these conditions or the not buying into the story our culture tells about having a lot of money or success or fame or being praised in the media, that, you know, you've lost your attachment to pursuing that kind of life. You have a different life than that. You have a different sense of what your priorities are. To quote Shakespeare, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Love that. They have come and gone for many of us. We are survivors of those slings and arrows. And we are survivors, usually with some wisdom. So we can look at these worldly winds and reflect on their place in our life. We can say, where do I still get caught? Is there something in being praised that I still just really look for and need? Or, you know, or am I still looking for that success that I never seem to fully feel? You know, just to reflect on how it is that these winds blow in our lives and how we can use the teachings to take another look at how we get caught, or take another look at how it is that we're no longer caught. Maybe we just don't feel drawn to some of the pursuits that we used to engage in. This is important because it empowers us. This way of looking at our experience can empower us to make other choices in our lives, to realize what our priorities truly are. So I can look back and see it all more objectively, and certainly the retreat added to that. I see that I have learned a lot from getting what I wanted, but perhaps even more have I learned from not getting what I wanted. Because whether you get what you want or you don't get what you want, life continues to unfold. I think one of the interesting questions is, I want to say it right. Where did I write it? Okay, here it is. What happens after the end of the story? They lived happily ever after. You know, that's always the end of the story when you're a child. They lived happily ever after. Even as a child, I kind of wondered, well, what happened, really? You know, like, what does that look like? They lived happily ever after. What happens after that? That's maybe the more interesting part of the story. It doesn't always get told. What happens after you lose all your money, or you you know, partner dies, what happens after you survive being shamed in some way in your life? Life goes on. Life goes on. It continues. And it continues to teach us if we don't get completely, you know, overwhelmed by something that occurs. Life goes on, you keep practicing, and many new insights continue to come, including the fact that you can always, always, always begin again. That little teaching may have long-term benefit in that if we remember, no matter what is happening in our life, oh, at any moment I can begin again. What does that mean? It means coming back to this experience and seeing what else is here other than the fact that I just felt really shamed, or what else is here even though I feel like a failure. What else is here? There's always more. There's always more. There's always more. There's always the opportunity to take another look, to retake another look at what we think is going on and see other possibilities that we hadn't considered. And that is such a liberating understanding. It's not a fantasy, it's real. What else is actually here that I can comprehend, that I can understand? So our grandfather, Ajahn Chah, Jack Kornfield's teacher, he was quite a teacher. So I'll leave you with what he said, which is no small challenge, but he said it, so I think we should hear what his view was. He said, the eight worldly winds will always be with us. Those winds will continue to blow. But true success with them is having them be of equal value. Boy, see what I mean? That's challenging. Praise and blame, equal value. Pleasure and pain, equal value. Pride and shame, equal value. Praise and blame, gain and loss, equal value. A little bit like what I was just saying, there's always more. There's always something more to learn, to see, to appreciate than just our sad story or our elated story. So, those are the words for tonight. Thank you for your attention. I hope some of this has been useful. And let's close with sharing the merit of our practice. Again, feeling the appreciation of everyone coming and being here together, and that something very good comes out of getting together like this and practicing together and supporting each other's practice. It's so important and so rare and so valuable. So thank you for coming, and may our practice indeed, indeed, indeed be for the benefit not only of ourselves, but each other, our families, our loved ones, our neighborhoods, our co-workers. Somehow may our practice help and bring benefit to those in need. Thank you.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.